Okay, we're recording. My name is Annalise Finney. I'm recording this interview for the Oral History Summer School Education Narratives Project. The interview is happening remote via Zoom. I'm in Oakland, California, and I'm here with Crystal Dillard.
Hi. Well, I am Crystal Dillard, and I am currently in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and I am the co-director of a self-directed learning center, which is a nonprofit that stands outside of the school paradigm, where we work with mostly homeschoolers, and we are Natural Creativity Center.
Okay. So to start, like I said, I want to ask you a little bit about yourself. Can you tell me about the place that you grew up?
Okay, I grew up in Los Angeles, California, and whenever I think about where I grew up, I always think about education just because that was so much a part of my journey. I grew up in the South Central Los Angeles area, Inglewood somewhat, and the public schools in my area were known to be underfunded and not very safe. And so my parents lied about my address so that I could always have access to better schooling.
Okay, and what were the schools like that you ended up going to?
They were very diverse. So they were very diverse, creative public schools, but there was a lot of, like, I look back and I realize there were things like there was art and there was gardening and lots of outdoor play and some project-based learning. I remember doing some project when I was in fifth grade where it was the gold rush and we worked in like pods where it, you know, we were simulating basically being, you know, in the gold rush.
Is that how you would describe your school system throughout school, or did it change depending on what school you were in?
No, I think that was pretty much that's a good description of what most of my schooling was like. I mean, of course, as you get into middle school and high school, it was all about academic rigor. I mean, even at that time, so being in honors classes and AP courses and this sort of college readiness idea by the time I was in high school.
What was it like for you to go to a school outside of your neighborhood?
I think there were challenges to it, like just getting there. I took public transportation, usually an hour there and an hour back. So just getting up really early in the morning and getting home later in the evening. And I remember being really tired and always napping on the bus. But there were really great things about it too, mostly that I got to meet all kind of people that I probably would not have met in my neighborhood. And I do believe that I was given access to a lot of different ideas of different lifestyles and different paths that someone's life could take that I may not have seen where I grew up, which I think prepared me for having an open mind about what my own journey would be like.
So what was your journey then to becoming an educator or working in education?
So I went to Howard University. So I left Los Angeles and went across the country and went to a historically Black college, which I think was a very important part of my journey because it was sort of a being surrounded and taught a lot about identity and about my culture that I didn't necessarily have the same relationship to growing up. So that was part of it. And wanting, you know, being in college and really wanting to have some kind of idea of changing the world. Like I had this idea because of where I grew up and what I saw in the schools that I was in, that there were, that inequity was there. Like that was obvious in my life. And so being in college, it was all about like, what can I do in this world to help people or to change things as, you know, the way they are. And so I had this idea of wanting to work with children, even though I didn't necessarily want to be a teacher or an educator. But I always kept getting jobs in education. Like those doors just opened for me automatically, including my work study program where I worked on campus at a child care center. And I loved it. Every time I did it, I loved it. And I continued to just work in education, and I started to see where social change could happen through education. And that made me want to go further with that. From there, I went on to get my master's, where I did get a master's of education, where I got to, you know, learn more about education and pedagogy and just the idea of all the different kinds of approaches there are to education. Though I will say that mostly it was all about high stakes testing and how to teach to the standards. And I mean, that was what I was being taught. But for me, I think I already had sort of a creative approach to education, and even just getting some of the philosophy of Dewey and Vygotsky just sort of enlivened something in me. And then from there, I sort of had this wandering journey through education where I worked in a 100-year-old private school in Northern Virginia, and then I worked in public education in Virginia, and I got to see what was different about that. And then I worked abroad in Cairo, Egypt for 6 months before their revolution, and I got a chance to see, you know, like what that was like. And then from there, I went on to work in progressive education in Los Angeles at a small, diverse school. I stayed there for 6 years, and that was sort of the awakening of my like creative education self, where I got a chance to see that education really could be about democracy, but it could also be about the individuals and what the individual's ideas were, and the creative self and getting to know yourself. But from there, I moved to Philadelphia, where I left the sort of bubble of goodness and went into the Philadelphia public school system, where I had I was in this urban environment with, you know, mostly Black, underprivileged children, and I got a chance to see, you know, the conditions of their school, the conditions of their schooling, the way they were treated, the way their teachers were treated, the way the administrators were treated. And I, having something to compare that to, I experienced a lot of frustration and sort of soul searching around like, who am I? What am I doing? And what do I want to be doing? Like, if I know that there is a better way, or that education can really be about the individual and about democracy and these things I care about, then can I continue to work for a system that I don't necessarily agree with? And during that time of sort of paying the bills and thinking about like, what will it look like? What will the next thing for me look like? I came across a self-directed learning center through a series of events that were all coincidental, that even involved a documentary film. I found out about self-directed learning, and self-directed learning as this idea of being outside the school paradigm and looking at what in the school paradigm as it exists can actually impede the individual from learning, from being creative, from being an individual, and how there are alternatives that are looking for better ways to do that. And so there was a self-directed learning center in the area that I was already working in, and I began to explore that. And very quickly, it was like a perfect match. And I've been there ever since. And for me, it's about community. And I live in the community that I work in, and I've always wanted that. I've pretty much always done that. That's always been important to me. And it's also about showing, it's about building something that is alternative, that's different on purpose, and giving as many families access to those alternative ways of education as possible.
So I'm curious, for somebody who doesn't know that much about what self-directed learning looks like, can you describe what a day of your work would look like in the time before COVID-19?
Well, before I just sort of describe what it would look like, just to give a context to what it is, it's thinking about a 2 or 3 year old and how 2 or 3 year olds have a natural way of learning. They learn through their 5 senses, and they don't need an adult. So they're doing everything they want to be doing, and they're learning through the things that they want to be doing. So if they want to climb something because they just want to climb something, then they're doing that and they don't need any encouragement, and they certainly don't need anyone to set them up for climbing. They just like go and literally do it. And adults tend to not get in their way because they're wanting to give that young person space to try and to do. And they understand that the trying and the doing is part of their learning process. Well, self-directed education takes that same idea, but takes it further by saying that's maybe always true. That if we as people could be pursuing the things that we want to do, then we would be learning by doing. And if we learn the process of how learning works, then we can pretty much apply that to anything that we want to learn about, and it will make us more capable people. And so what that looks like for us is that we have 4 to 18-year-olds in a one space. Some people come to us one day a week, and some people come as many as 4 days a week. And when they're with us, there is lots of materials there and lots of space. And we have all kinds of space that might be designated, such as a library and an art room and a lab. And we have laptops and lots of tools and a wood shop, which is also really important. Wood shop and garden and outdoor space and gym. We have these sort of open spaces to explore. And we don't really keep any of the exploration from happening. We just allow that to happen naturally. At the same time, we do sit with young people and their families. We have a partnership model where we ask the young person with their family there, like, what do you want to be learning about? What do you want to be doing? What's something you want to know more about or get better at? And then there are goals that are set out at the beginning of a program year and then are revisited throughout. And then pretty much an individual program arises out of that young person's interests. And by the time a young person starts to get a little older, you know, let's say they're teens, we start to ask them questions about, you know, what they want to be doing in the world, what they see as, you know, a plan for themselves. And we support them in thinking about the things that they want to be doing in a long-term way. And we try to support them not only with doing that in our space, but then connecting to internships or things in our community would allow them to be doing the things that they want to do.
Wow, that sounds like a program that is very unique and very different. How do people react to you usually when you describe that?
I feel like there are people who that just really resonates with, and they're like, yes, that's what I think education should be. Or people who immediately begin to question. And usually the questions are around, well, what about reading? Well, what about math? Well, are they college ready? You know, and so I get both of those responses. And usually the people who have the questions about all of those things are not against anything about what we're doing, other than it is sometimes what I would perceive as a fear of the unknown and a fear of who are young people going to be if we're not telling them what to do? I think that that's a question that people have. And I think that we have a paradigm in education that says that there are certain set and prescribed things that everyone needs to know. Even that there are set things that we all need to know to even be effective in a democracy. And so if we carry those ideas, if we believe that, then thinking of a place that's not pushing an agenda is not necessarily attractive for people. So I get both of those responses.
Okay. I'm curious, what does your normal work day look like? When you wake up in the morning, what did your day look like before COVID-19?
Yeah. Well, my day is still coming into picture. I'm a newer leader. I mean, I literally started working with this self-directed learning center in January. So what my day looked like, I can describe it, but I'll preface it by saying it looked like someone who was new to a leadership role who needed to spend a lot of time observing and getting to know and understand the philosophy and the people and the inner workings before taking on too much. And then of course, I think COVID-19 has thrown all of that out the window and has accelerated my need to jump in and do and learn and be creative right away. So most of my days prior to this were actually observing. So showing up, you know, to my center before the young people where we're all setting up and making sure things are prepared, being there through the day, and then spending time shadowing young people, spending time shadowing facilitators, and just seeing the day-to-day interaction to learn, you know, more about our approach and what we do and how the things that we're doing, even though it could sound permissive to some, is actually really intentional. There's a lot of really intentional ways that we speak to young people and talk to young people in terms of building respect and supporting their autonomy and growth as creative, collaborative, and compassionate human beings, which are three of our like main ideas that we do. I mean, we do come with an agenda, and I would say those are our three agendas out of everything we could choose. And so I was spending a lot of my time learning about that and then slowly doing it. So taking the time to have those individual relationships with young people, building relationships with facilitators and families, and then to some extent, even jumping in myself as a facilitator in terms of offering or initiating activities. We do initiate activities with young people. The difference is that it's nothing that we do is really required as much as it is offerings, and young people are joined because they want to. And if it's not something they're interested in, then they don't.
Okay. Tell me about how you first became aware of COVID-19.
I think the first thing that I became familiar with was something was happening in China. So on the news and in social media, I knew that there was an illness that was happening, a virus that was happening in China, and people were concerned about it. I remember there being a video of some of the doctors in China who are trying to share what was going on and some of their fears about it. And there was controversy and there was a little bit of fear that was involved in it. And then there started to be cases that were here in the US. And very quickly, it just seemed to escalate from a few cases, you know, in China, it's happening there, to a few cases here, to things are now shutting down. And I remember at the very beginning of it, we started really implementing lots of cleaning practices and things very quickly. And we sort of were trying to do things to stop the spread of a virus right then and there. But that very quickly escalated to schools in the area closing and realizing that, you know, we were going to have to take that same action.
Why did you feel the need to take the same action?
Well, for one, our community was asking for it. We have all kinds of families. I mean, the fact that we're dealing with homeschooling families, we have everything from anti-vaxxers to scientists. Like, scientists' children are there. And early on, because we had a few immunocompromised young people, we had families who had stopped sending them. I think in the last week or two before we closed, they had stopped sending their young people to us out of safety for themselves. And then the more scientific, particularly the scientist family that we have, was sending us information and very quickly letting us know, you know, what was going on with the CDC. And they were sending us the most up-to-date websites, because I feel like the scientists, like, right away, just like built websites. Like, there were just websites that were just there automatically in the beginning of this. And so when they're showing you this website that's literally showing you all the cases across the country, and it's showing you the projections and what to be expected and what happens if we don't, that was really the time that we realized, like, this is really serious. This is not going to go away overnight. And it is the responsible thing, whether the school district is closing or not, that we close now. And I believe we did close maybe a week before the school district of Philadelphia chose to close.
Mm-hmm. How did you feel during that transition?
Lots of anxiety. Lots of anxiety, not knowing what was going to happen, mostly first just the health side of it. I mean, I was concerned about the health side of it, of anyone contracting it from our community, me contracting it or my family. So there was like anxiety and fear around that. And then pretty soon after, I think I began thinking about what's going to happen to our organization. I mean, we were really creative. And so we very quickly sort of gathered ourselves and came up with ideas and figured out who we could be and how we could still support. But I still underlying had a fear of what was going to happen to our organization. We're very small, 45 young people, like very small community. And so I just didn't know if we were going to be able to keep people interested enough and what we were doing, and if families were going to feel like what they were getting from us was enough to keep paying for, and whether that was going to affect our ability to continue paying our staff. And so it was a time of fear.
What was it like to be a leader during that time?
Well, it was, some of it was empowering because I was in this transitional place where I was just sort of new to what we were doing and coming in to understand. Well, all of that being new and like taking my time and figuring out what's been done before so I can figure out how to, I mean, all of that just went immediately out the window because things needed to happen every single day and we needed to figure out what we were doing. So it was actually an empowering time to be a leader for me to sort of step in and realize that there were things that I could do right then and there that I didn't have to wait. You know, I think because I came into a position where I had a co-director in the beginning, it was at the beginning of our relationship was me learning from him. And suddenly when we got to this COVID-19 time and social distancing, it really didn't, the playing field was even. And it didn't matter who knew what we used to do because we all needed to just be thinking about what we were going to do now. And so it was a really empowering time in terms of just sort of stepping into the role of a leader and making decisions and making and doing things and helping the staff implement things right away. So it was an empowering time, I think, as a leader.
Where did you look for mentorship or leadership for yourself?
I was already very connected. I'm because I've been in education for over 15 years, I belong to a lot of organizations. I have a lot of relationships with educators throughout the country. Progressive educators and teacher coaches, because my last job, I was a teacher coach. So progressive educators and teacher coaches and organizations that I've belonged to, and I just tapped into what everyone was doing. I just wanted to know, like, what are you doing? How are you coming up with your solutions? And there were so many conversations. It just felt like I was having so many meetings on Zoom with people across the country about what they were doing and how they were coming up with it. I also got a lot of support from, I belong to a philosophical group that usually meets during the summer. And it's full of teachers from across the country, but it's also full of professors. And I actually got a lot of support from professors. They have a really great Facebook group that was created like immediately. It was just professors around the country coming up with their solutions, and their solutions were great and useful. And yeah, that's what I did. I just sort of tapped into the relationships I already had, and it wasn't all applicable, and especially because we're not a school. But just looking at some of the tools that people were using, like Padlet or Zoom and all the different things that can happen on Zoom, it did give me a starting point to think about how can we use technology to move forward.
And how did you do that?
We continued having, we had a lot of different ways that we worked with people, young people and families. For one, we realized that there were things that we could do to adapt to what young people needed, and we did that very quickly. So for young people, we thought about what are the most important things, what are the touchstones that young people would still need to feel connected to a community? You know, what are things that young people need? They'll need to feel still connected to a community, still connected to their partners, still feel some sense of connection to whatever their goals were. So even if they're at home, they can continue doing that. And then they may need some resources to keep them engaged in the process of learning in whatever way they're doing it. And so we created a few things right away. We created like a schedule that involved just a daily offering of a group time so that young people had something that they could connect with other young people on a consistent basis that they knew would be there every day. We pretty quickly started developing like clubs that were based around things young people were interested in still doing with one another, like Dungeons and Dragons for the teens and Minecraft for some of the younger ones, and a comic club and cooking, and like some of the things that were just obvious to our community that they would want to still continue. We created a sense of a schedule with that and continue to offer and just hold space for it to happen. And then we made sure that our partners, which means like a facilitator who has a relationship with a young person, was calling on at least a weekly basis and saying, hey, how's it going? What are your goals? Are you still working on those? Like, what are you doing at home? And how can I support you to continue doing that? So those are some of the things that we just did immediately for young people. And then we also had on Padlet, we would just, all of the free things that the world exploded with, all the offerings, like all the hundreds of difference of, you know, there was like meet a neuropsychologist, like literally, and an astronaut, and, you know, art classes being offered by Mo Willems, which was incredible. There were like all these things that just popped up. And so we created a Padlet where we just kept track of all those different offerings. And then we had Slack that all of our families were connected to so that we could advertise some of the things that were coming up, and we could keep communication constantly going with the Slack. But then we also had the Padlet as just a home for all the different activities that the facilitators could be helping their partners connect with, and so could families. And then on the parenting side, we realized like we had always seen ourselves as a partnership model with parents, but during COVID-19, where suddenly no one knew what was going on, parents were really affected. I mean, sometimes more than young people. Young people were sort of, in our community, were used to being home because they're considered homeschoolers and they spend lots of time at home. But parents who are suddenly maybe not working or now with their young person much more than they had ever expected to be, just based on what their lifestyle was like. We really tried to make sure that we were supporting our parents just as much as we were supporting young people. So we made sure that we were calling them on a weekly basis, that partners had that weekly basis relationship with parents, and we knew what was happening with them. We created an emergency fund pretty quickly. We were able to get some funding pretty quickly around emergency, and we made sure that that money went directly towards families. So we made sure if we had families who needed food, that we were able to buy groceries, we were able to pay some bills, we were able to just create an emergency funding situation for any families that we knew, and, you know, keeping the lines of communication open so families knew that if they were having struggles, they could talk to us, that we were reaching out and we wanted to help. And then also, just from a parenting angle, all the struggles that came with being home and siblings and all those things, making sure that we were supporting them with that. We have our own model of how we work with conflicts with young people. And so wanting to extend that model to parents so that they could be using some of our problem solving tools, both for themselves and their life, but also for their young people and their family in terms of managing conflicts. And so we also had like a once a week happy hour, Zoom happy hour for parents, where they could just come and talk and Yeah. It wasn't as used as we would have liked because I think people were just living like with their young people. So just even getting away was tough, but we definitely created space for that. And I know moving forward, that idea of supporting adults as much as you're supporting young people is still really important to us.
How did you become aware of that need that parents needed support to?
You know, that's such a really good question. I think if I'm being honest, a lot of it came because my co-director, Chris Steinmeier, is a parent. He has two young people, a three-year-old and a two-year-old. And he was home and his wife was home and they were experiencing the day-to-day of how do you manage that? How do you manage trying to work online with the two of you while also having these young people who need your attention? I mean, especially a 2 and a 3 year old, but I believe his experience with having that so visceral brought a lot of compassion for all of us of what everyone is experiencing. And then also at the time, I mean, our parents also have a very open relationship with us. And so they were telling us, you know, like what was happening with them and what, and we kept, like at the time, my co-director and I ended up just by a series of events, we were sort of on a press junket for a documentary that's about our center. And in all of the conversations that we were having, because COVID-19 was coming up no matter what, even if that's not what we were there for, and we kept making this comment that in some ways our community was more prepared for something like this than other places because they homeschool, because their young people are used to being home, because their young people are self-directed. So they're not looking for an adult to tell them what they should be doing with their time. And so in some ways we were more prepared, but there we also acknowledged and know for sure that no one was prepared for this, no one. And that this was a challenging time for people on so many different levels, like levels that people were not even talking about. Mm-hmm. That, you know, whether it be like their own personal health, the health of their family, their finances, just fear of the future and not knowing what was going to happen. Mm-hmm. I mean, all those things were happening at one time. And so because we were all, and then I think also like we as facilitators and as leaders were also experiencing this. You know, my father-in-law, unfortunately, did contract COVID-19. He very recently passed after a long battle with it. And I mean, just to say, like, we were people experiencing this pandemic just as much as our families were. So the way that we knew that they would have been struggling or may have struggled, because there have definitely been people who have thrived. I mean, we've seen that in our community. There are people thriving in this, and there are young people who are thriving in this. But as far as the like really hard parts of it, like we're living it, you know, we're in it too.
Mm-hmm. Where did you find support for yourself during all of that?
Well, I mean, my family, you know, it's my husband and myself. So having one another was supportive. And then, as I mentioned before, just my own support community. I'm very much a people person and I have very deep relationships. And so during this time, staying in contact with the people who I love and care about and who I know love and care about me was really important. So that sometimes that was family. Sometimes those were, you know, friends. And then other times they were coworkers, you know, along the way. So I do feel like there has been a lot of support. And I do think that because we're all experiencing this together, there's sort of a shared understanding of like, yeah, this is really hard.
Yeah. What do you know now about yourself that you didn't know before this?
Sleeping in is really good for me. I mean, really, I mean, I knew that before, but being able to wake up in a natural way. So it's not so much about like waking up at 12 o'clock in the afternoon as it is waking up with no alarm clock, and the way that that changes like the pace that my day goes is really important for me. And that is something I've learned about myself in this time. I also think I was reminded of just my own resiliency, and specifically my resiliency in the way of just being willing and able to respond to any new thing. Like something new comes and the ability to just like show up for that is there. And I think that I got a chance to see that in myself in all of this. I also think I had a chance to connect to my own creativity. So there are things that I love to do, including I'm a writer. I've always journaled. And over time I've written poetry and short stories and things like that. But most of the time I don't have time to work on those because I'm so busy, always busy, you know, busy. And this time has really allowed me to tap into my creative self in ways that I wasn't able to do before the pandemic.
Has that informed your work at the school at all? At the Knott School?
At the Knott School. I think it will. I think it hasn't yet because we've been in the summertime and so we were not meeting during summer. But I think in terms of the kinds of things that I will want to offer up for young people, I think it will definitely affect, you know, me wanting to connect to other people around. Well, I have to think about that. Because in fact, I was always doing those things. Because I love reading and writing, I was always thinking of the reading and the writing aspects of learning. And I've always been like offering that. I mean, even before I came into the organization fully, I was, you know, at book fairs purchasing new diverse books that I thought our library could use. Like I was already, that's just such a part of who I am. And so I was already bringing that in. I think I just connected literally to the need to provide myself with the time that I need to do the things that I really love that are sort of outside of my job. And I guess in terms of bringing that into my year and bringing that into the program, it's about me continuing to find space to connect to myself. To some degree, all of this is about what self-directed education is about. And I think I would have been doing this in my time of like leaving a more kind of corporate sense of schooling into this small, hands-on, creative space, I think I would have been getting to letting go a sense of needing to have it all look a certain way and needing my schedule to be a certain way and embracing a more self-directed life that includes doing the things you really love and want to be doing, and making sure that you're nurturing that and not overpacking your schedule so that there's no space for it. I think in some ways that would have happened to me eventually in this role, no matter what. I think COVID-19 just like accelerated that.
So I know that you mentioned that it's summertime and you haven't been working as much during the summer. When does your next program year begin?
It begins in the middle of September, and we've been working in the past, it's been 2 weeks. We've had two almost full weeks now of planning. So we're already in the planning phase, and we are really working with our community and with our community in the sense of what parents want and need, what young people are asking for, and what our facilitators are interested and willing and engaged in wanting to do. So like between all of that, it's been a very creative and slow process. But I know going into the fall that we're looking at developing pods. And our pods would be pods of about 10 young people. We are going to divide these up sort of by age. So there'll be like a teen group, a middle age group, and then a younger group of about 10 young people who meet twice a week in an outdoor location. And that a lot of our programming when we're in those pods will be about nature and using the natural world as a learning space, as a space to engage in. And then outside of that, we will like sort of bubble wrap those times that we're meeting around all the other things we were already doing when COVID started. So making sure that we still have a daily meeting that young people can come on and still have this sense of clubs that are like clubs or classes, because I think we're also now moving not just towards clubs, but also specific classes that young people might want to take that are going on that they can choose. And then our partnership model of creating those goals. And so we know that there will be some families who are fully engaged in pods and they're really here for that because that's part of what they really want. And then we're going to have some families who are going to choose not to participate in that part, who might only, you know, work with us on what we offer virtually.
So what does that mean for your work day? What will your days look like?
My days will look like 2 days a week being out in a pod with young people, which I'm actually really excited. I love nature. And I'm really excited about having the chance to be outdoors in nature with young people on a consistent basis. I think that, I mean, we tend to say this, but like, honestly, there are things about this time that have been an opportunity. And one of the opportunities is getting to connect to the natural world and giving young people the opportunity to see like all the things that can happen creatively outdoors. And so 2 days a week, I know I'll be outdoors with young people doing all sorts of things. I have a feeling gardening is going to be a large part of it. And I'm also hoping there'll be some animals involved because there are some goats around, which will be really cool to work with some goats and farming and then again, just like big open fields. So all kinds of things can happen there. I think so 2 days a week, I know I'll be doing that. And outside of those, I know that there'll be other times where I'll be offering some online classes, some things that I really love to do that I know I'll want to share as an offering for young people. And we'll see who wants to show up for that. I already have some things in mind for myself personally that I know I want to teach and offer to people who want to be doing that. And then outside of that, there are lots of administrative things, obviously, that go into having a small nonprofit. So there will be lots of meetings that happen. We are in the middle of property acquisition that had started prior to COVID, that slowed down because of COVID, but has not stopped. So this will be working with a project manager on what is needed and contractors and all those things. So lots of meetings outside of the young people.
How are you feeling about what comes next?
I'm excited about the outdoor opportunity and the pods. I mean, I think initially we were thinking we would be all virtual, and I certainly wasn't expecting us to be meeting, doing anything face-to-face, but there was really a push for that from our community, and I'm excited actually about that. I mean, after months of not having any kind of contact, I'm actually excited about being creative about how to do that. There's still that heavy sort of anxiety, fear of the future thing, because I don't know. Like I don't know what the world is gonna be like. And so I also, again, there's still that, as a leader, that sneaky feeling in the back of your head of like, are people gonna stay with this? Like how many people will enroll and how long are they gonna be willing to do it? And what happens if we don't have people wanting to continue to engage, and, you know, are we going to be able to continue like I feel confident that we have everything we need to do at least one program year with the model we have and have everyone get paid and have us keep building things. But I don't know about anything beyond that. And because I don't know what's going to happen with the world and whether we're going to have some kind of vaccine ready, and are people going to take the vaccine? What happens if they don't take the vaccine? And are we going to have to enforce some kind of vaccine rule? And how will that change the nature of our work or our relationship with families? And there's a lot of unknowns. And so I'm excited about some of the things that are coming right away and sort of living in the moment of that. But there's still that sort of fear up in the air of not knowing, like, literally what's going to happen.
On that note, I'm curious about how current events over the last 4 months and looking forward tend to affect your school, whether that's the upcoming election or the protests around the police killings of George Floyd, among other people. And I'm curious, how does that play into what happens in your learning community?
I think we have to continue to be present to figure out what that means. I know that with the protests and the killings of George Floyd and others, and the sort of response that there's been to that, immediately there was a sense of, because especially just to say, like, we are in a Black community, we're located in a Black community, that's sort of, to me, it's a community that's historically had a struggle around race, because it's this Black community with really incredible, rich history. Literally, it was part of the Underground Railroad, where Harriet Tubman, like, the Johnson House is down the street from my house and down the street from our program, of where, was one of the last stops on the Underground Railroad. And there's this really rich history there. But then that history between then and now has been embroiled in a tug of war of who gets to tell the story of this area, who gets to live in this area, what businesses get to be here, what kind of housing do people get to have? Like, there's just been like a lot of struggles in this area. And when this happened, and there was looting that happened in our area. There were protests, but there was also looting in our area. And for us as an organization, we knew it was like this moment that I think a lot of organizations went through of, well, what do you say? Or what do you do? And we thought about what we wanted to say and what we wanted to do early on. A lot of it was saying, obviously, these things are horrible, and we stand by everyone who wants to protest for change, knowing good and well, like, there's been this history and it's not okay. And we acknowledge that, and we want that acknowledged. And then there was a moment of really sort of encouraging strongly that parents not push this to the side, that parents be willing to have difficult conversations and not hide what's happening for their young people, because it's hard for them to have the conversation. So we are in a Black neighborhood, but we are pretty racially mixed, 50% white and 50% people of color, and that people of color including biracial families, Asian families, and Black families, some of which who live in the community. Lots of people actually live in our community. And so that was our initial response. And then there was also a response of us as an organization, as leaders, knowing that we needed to be prepared to take that further. That yes, there's this initial response and we all needed to just like know what we needed to say or do right then, but that we need to make sure that we are doing our part, both as an organization that's willing to look at ourselves and moving outward to the way that we interact with families and the way that we interact with young people, what we're saying to young people and how we are representing or not representing the continuation of white supremacy or not. We're either dismantling that or not. And what does that look like for a self-directed learning center? And in some ways, like the work that we're doing is already pushing against that, because our goal is to change systems. We exist outside of the school paradigm because we're saying that system is fully set up for white supremacy. That's one of the problems with it. So instead of doing that, we're going to do this very alternative thing that looks at the human and lets the human choose what they want to be doing. And essentially, that should be something that is good and in many ways anti-racist, except we're still in this context. And so we know that there's a lot of grappling that we have to do, that there is no simple answer to any of this. And we don't want to take the easy way out, where we just say, like, because what we're doing is different, we don't really have to do that. And so we are, you know, my co-director and I have been spending some time all summer long, the two of us, attending events, attending conferences, having conversations, reading, listening to things, having a really deep dive. And I think our deep dives are a little bit different, with me being a Black leader and him being a non-Black leader. And so for him, I think it's been a lot of like just learning and taking in and pushing his knowledge even more. And for me, it's been about healing and understanding how to hold space for myself and how to hold space for other Black families as they grapple with the fact that there's so much newness happening for some people that is not new at all for us. And how do we like be in this moment and see what is good about it, but then also be able to continue taking care of ourselves and sort of continuing to, I want to say ready ourselves for the continuous fight that we've been in our entire lifetime against these things. And so there's a lot of work to be done. And I think that what we've been mapping out so far, after taking all of that in and continuing to, is a process of at least 3 years of development, you know, with our staff, that starts off with us just working on ourselves as individuals, building the tools that we need to even have these conversations, and building the tools we need to become more present with ourselves, to understand what we're thinking and what we're feeling, and preparing ourselves to have really more serious and pointed conversations as individuals about race, period. And that's like year one. And beyond that, we have to continue to map out what year two and year three will look like as we realize that this is a big undertaking. And I hope that we're not going to be the only organization that's undertaking it, and that what this country is facing will not just be another moment of being shocked at what we see, you know, on the news, and then walking away and taking no action. So my hope is that as we do our work in these next 3 years, that this country will be doing its work. And then obviously, looking at the election and what's coming, all of this, we have a very, I want to say strangely diverse political atmosphere in our community. And I think that we will need to continue that sort of anti-racist work that I'm talking about, that is really this first year about the self and the individual and the tools that you need to even sit and have these conversations. We as staff need to be in that space in order to be able to hold space for the fact that we are going to have so much divisiveness coming out of this election, and that though we believe in compassion and creativity and collaboration, that's the way we have to show up when people are having whatever their beliefs are. But at the same time, it's not our space, and I still believe strongly it's not our space to push our political agendas on young people or on families. But we certainly need to be able to show up to whatever is said, or in a way, you know, that is compassionate and not harmful to anyone.
I want to be respectful of your time tonight, and we've been talking for about an hour. I want to wrap up soon, but before we wrap up, I wanted to ask if there's anything that you want to make sure to put on the record about this time for yourself, or something that maybe you just want to remember in the years that come about what this time has meant for you and what you've seen and experienced.
I want to remember that I'm a human being and that oftentimes, you know, in our work life, just in the way that our world is set up now, that we show up to work and we're like a worker when we're at work. And then you go home and you're like a person when you're at home. But that in fact, you're always actually this human being who's like going to these places and doing these things, but you're just a human. And I think that for me, COVID-19 in this social distance time has really put me in touch with my own humanity and with the need to be in touch with that humanity all the time, including when I'm working. And my hope for myself and for others is that when we leave this time, we don't forget that we're humans and that we, as jobs, so for myself as a leader especially, make sure that we are handling our work, not only with ourselves, but with our staff members as human beings who are doing a role, but also have many other things that they juggle and they do. I really just hope that we have a more compassionate stance on that. And that includes families and parenting and how much time it takes, grief. I mean, even just grief, you know, and that we be willing to offer the space that's necessary for people to be humans and not just workers.
Thank you. I'm going to pause the recording, so one moment.